Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad?
What's going on, man?
Dude, it's going on. It's going on. All the things are going on, and we have come to this point in history where, once again, do you realize this is episode 71. We didn't make a big deal out of it last episode, but last episode was episode 70. We've made this is
that's a very biblical episode, you know.
Yeah, it seems like we should have done something.
I mean, that ranks right up there with 10 and 40 and 12 and 20. Yeah, I mean, 70 episodes, got the 70 elders.
Yeah,
we're moving along.
Yeah, so this is 71. I've decided in my mind that I don't know what we're gonna do. We're gonna do something great. We're gonna do on episode 100. I don't know what's gonna happen, but we're gonna do something.
It'll be big.
We missed 70, but this is it. So 71. I was like, man, I can't believe that this is the 71st time that we have done this.
It's good. Good stuff. I don't know how long we'll be in Exodus, but I'm guessing we'll still be in Exodus by the time we get to 100.
Probably so. I'm also shocked that I know that there's people who have listened all the way. I mean, there's a lot of people that listen to this, and there's a big percentage of them that have listened to most of the people that listen that go all the way back. When you could tell by the episodes that get downloaded all the time, most people end up listening to an episode along the way, and then they go all the way back and start over. And so the fact that there's people out there that have listened to us do this 70 times, and they've listened to 60 hours of me and you talk, is, I got to tell you guys, that is shocking.
That is very shocking. They must be very patient people.
Yeah. But let me say also, we really, really appreciate you guys doing that. And as much, it's shocking and humbling that so many of you have listened for this long and continue to download and listen every week. So thank you very much.
We're very grateful. I mean, we got folks, of course, in the U.S., but I've received emails from listeners in Australia and England and Germany and elsewhere. So it's great that it's getting all around the globe. So we're grateful for everybody out there who's listening and joining us on the weekly studies.
Yeah. Well, right on, man. Well, I think we're gonna get plagued this week. I think we thought we were gonna get it last week. This week, I think most assuredly the plagues are going to arrive.
Yeah. It's gonna get pretty dirty here pretty soon. We're gonna get our 10 plagues, beginning after a brief episode dealing with snakes. And then we're gonna be in the plagues for the next few chapters. So, lots of gospel coming up.
Buckle up, guys.
So we left off at around Exodus chapter 7, verse 8 last time. We had the genealogy that was kind of a pause in the narrative, brought us up to speed on how we got to the birth of Moses and Aaron, these two central figures in the story. And we're told that Moses was 80, and that his brother was 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. So after this narrative pause, we're going to get right back into the story now. So beginning here with Exodus 7, 8, it says that God talked to Moses and Aaron, and he told them that when they go to see Pharaoh, he wanted them to work a miracle. And this miracle is the one that Moses says has already prepped for, already back in the burning bush, because God says he wants him to, for Aaron to take his staff and throw it in front of Pharaoh, and it's going to become a snake. And that's exactly what they did. So these two brothers, they go to Pharaoh. They did just what God told them to do. Aaron throws down his staff in front of Pharaoh and his cohorts, and lo and behold, it becomes a serpent. I had to laugh. I was reading one commentary on this, and it does make I think an interesting point that the Hebrew word here for serpent is a different word than what was used back in the burning bush. Back in the burning bush, the word that was used means a snake, means a regular serpent. But here, The word that the Hebrew word that's used can mean crocodile. Now doesn't that just put a whole different spin on this your vision of what's going on here? Aaron throws down his staff and it becomes a ta'anim, which could have been a serpent, but also could have been a crocodile. Is that what you learned in Sunday school?
That is not. I like that though.
I kind of do, you know what? And it sort of fits because, I mean, you got the Nile, which we're going to get to in just a second, and you got crocodiles in the Nile. So it kind of fits with the whole, Egyptian ethos and the animals that they would associate with violence and vigor and danger and all of these things. So when Aaron throws down his staff and it becomes a crocodile, now, hey, I, when I was in Sunday school, I think I would have liked that story even better.
It eats up the other one.
Yeah, and then the crocodile turns around, because of course, if you know the story, Pharaoh's calls for his wise men and his sorcerers, and they did the same thing. They throw down their staffs, and through some of their magical arts, they turn into ta'anim, which could be serpents, could be crocodiles, but whatever they were, whatever long dangerous animal these staffs turned into, Aaron's staff turns right around and swallows up theirs. So whether you want to picture Aaron's snake swallowing up the snakes of Pharaoh's magicians, or his crocodile swallowing up the crocodiles of the wise men, either way, that's what happened. So it's kind of it's like a big joke in many ways, because these Egyptian magicians think, oh, that's no big deal. We can do that too. Look, we can turn our staffs into animals as well. And then Aaron turns around and his one staff swallows up all of these staffs of the magicians, which in many ways is kind of a window into what's about to happen, because we're going to see God's victory over and over again against the Egyptians and the magicians in the 10 plagues.
I'm choosing to believe that it was a little bit of both. So it's like
it was like a serpent crocodile.
Yeah, it's like a croc-a-snake thing where it's, you don't know what it is. You're like, is that a snake? Was it a crocodile? What is that? And it's just like a dragon.
Yeah, I like that croc-a-snake. We got a new animal.
Yeah, just crazy thing.
I think I saw one of those at the zoo the other day.
Yeah,
croc-a-snake.
Croc-a-snake, dude. Whatever. I don't know what that'd be. I don't know how to put those two words together.
Well, if you're listening to this podcast, and perhaps you teach a Bible class or Sunday school, you're going to have a whole new spin on this story to tell to your students next time you cover it.
Yeah, well, you'd be like, I know that my kid has drawn some animals that I'm not sure of. Now I'll be like, oh, that's a serpentile. I know what that is.
Yeah, it's either a serpentile or a croc-a-snake. I'm not sure. One of the two. So anyway, that's kind of you might think of this as sort of the preface to what's about to follow. We have this confrontation between the two brothers and Pharaoh. We have the working of a miracle, and through this miracle, the demonstration of the superiority of Yahweh over the Egyptians. And that kind of sets the stage then for everything that's about to come as we begin the 10 plagues. So are we ready to go there?
Dude, we're ready. Let's do it.
All right. So I want to say a few things about just kind of in general about these plagues to kind of set the stage for what's coming up, because I think it's helpful. If you before we begin looking individually at this first one and then the subsequent ones, to kind of get the bigger picture of these plagues, so that we can kind of see them as a totality and the structure of the total number of plagues, kind of gives us an idea as to what God is doing in using these plagues against Egypt. Now, the first thing I think is interesting, this is the time when I wish we were kind of on video so that I could show everybody this. But I'm looking at a chart that's from a book by Nahum Sarna, who's a Jewish scholar. It's called Exploring Exodus, and he talks, of course, about the plagues. And he's not the only one who's done this. He and many others have noted that there's a very clear structure to all 10 plagues. So it's like, you know, God knew all of this was going to happen. And when it was written down, it was written down in such a way that you could see how everything follows a certain sequence. Things don't just kind of happen haphazardly. It's not as if God gives plague one and he really hadn't planned on plague two, but then he goes ahead and does plague two and he thought maybe that would do it, but no, he needs another one. So he does plan three. No, there's a whole structure to the plagues. I'm just giving you a couple of examples to see how this works. So you got the first three are a unit. So it's the first three are three plagues or one series. And then the next three, four, five, and six are a series of plagues. And then you have a final three series, seven, eight, and nine. And then 10 stands alone. It's like, because it is the, it's the worst. It's the most cataclysmic of the plagues. It kind of stands alone. So you got three groups of three series of plagues each. And then within each of these, they follow the exact same structure. So for instance, in each of the series, in one and two, and in four and five, and in seven and eight, in every single one of these, Pharaoh is forewarned that the plague is going to happen. So the first two, there's a forewarning. The third just happens. Four and five, he's forewarned. And then six just happens. Seven and eight, he's forewarned. And nine just happens. And then it's kind of the same structure when it comes to when these plagues happen. So the very first in each of these series, so number one and number four and number seven, they all happen in the morning, every single one of them. And then the others in those sequence just happen. And we're even told in each of these three series, it follows the same structure where Moses is supposed to go when this plague is about to happen. So in each of these three series, he's told in one and four and in seven that he's supposed to station himself before Pharaoh when these plagues are about to happen. So, I mean, there's a whole lot more that I could go into there, but just kind of give you some examples to show that it's like if you remember way back in Genesis 1, there was a certain structure to the creation narrative. So the first 3 days kind of create a space that days four, five, and six fill in with particular. So there's a definite structure to the creation narrative. Now, when you get to Exodus 7 and the chapters that follow it, we've got another clear structure, except this time, it's not a structure of creation, but it's a structure of uncreation. What God is doing in Egypt is basically reversing Genesis chapter 1. So the plagues, you can think of the plagues this way. They're kind of God's way of plague by plague by plague, uncreating Egypt. So he's taking away the blessings of creation and he's putting in their place darkness or pestilence or blood or gnats or lice or any of these other things that are part of creation that basically are making creation to preach the law to the Egyptians, show them God's wrath, and call them to repentance. So the plague cycle is God working as creator, revealing his anger against Egypt and Pharaoh in particular by un-Genesis wanting, if you will, the work that he did in Egypt when he created it to begin with. So that's kind of another thing to keep in mind when we're looking at the plagues, is kind of the implication, the theological implication of the plagues, and that's one of the big things. is that the plagues reveal that God preaches the law in these acts of uncreation, because what he's ultimately doing is he's reducing Pharaoh and he's reducing the Egyptians. He's putting them down to their knees. He's reducing them to nothing in order that he might demonstrate that he is the Lord, that they've rebelled against him, and that they need to repent.
Yeah, God happens to use creation a lot to do this kind of thing. I mean, that's what he does with the flood.
Another great example of him uncreating the whole world in that case in response to sin.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that we often think about this, but we have the same thing that happens all the time in the world today. I mean, the very fact that we have tornadoes, that we have hurricanes, that we have floods, that we have fires, we have all of these things that happen in creation that are not the way, that they don't fall under the category of good or very good of Genesis chapter 1. All of these are symptoms of a world gone wrong. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, if a tornado hits a small town in Texas, that, oh, that town must have been just a terrible town full of awful people, but that was a lot worse than the town that was spared. No, that's not the point. The point is that every time that something like that happens in creation, it's a reminder to us of the fallenness of creation, the fallenness of ourselves, and the fact that this world is royally messed up. So in that sense, they're a constant call to repentance for all humanity, because this is that kind of groaning of creation that Paul talks about in Romans chapter 8 as it waits for the revealing of the sons of God. So creation is groaning. Creation is broken. Creation is full of all kinds of tumultuous things that cause all sorts of harm to humanity. And this too is a reminder of the fact that just as our world nature is broken, so are we. It all began with us to begin with.
Too much pollen is nature groaning, and tornadoes and hurricanes is like nature screaming out to be recreated.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. I mean, anything. I mean, even the fact that nature itself is so bloodthirsty and violent. I mean, all of this is, if we have eyes to see, we see the preaching of the law in the world all around us. You know, people talk about going out into nature and feeling close to God, and I get that. I mean, creation does declare the glory of God, and the heavens declare the work of his hands, as the psalmist says. But also when you go out into creation, you see how bad the world is, because you see how broken it is. You see violence, you see destruction, you see the earth coming unraveled in many cases. And so all of this is a demonstration of how sin has affected not just humanity, but animals and nature in general.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell this even in pagan cultures where they create gods after parts of nature, whether it's the sun or you know, you have like Thor, and you know, when there's lightning, when there's massive storms, that's, you know, Thor beating his anvil or all that kind of stuff. But they're not like the conclusion that they come to is not, okay, like each of these things in nature are a god, and these gods are really loving and kind. No, like that, they come to the conclusion by looking at broken, fallen nature that these are gods that need to be appeased because they'll kill us all. That's the conclusion that all pagan religions come to, that worship things like that. That is nature is not simply, like, that's why you got to make sacrifices to it, because I mean it'll take its own if that's what it needs to do.
And yeah, so that's a great point. All of these, all of the kind of the divination of creation is mankind's attempt to, in some way, placate the anger of the gods. You know, if we know that there's a volcano god, and we're afraid the volcano is going to erupt, then we need to maybe try and placate the wrath of this god. Or if there's a tornado god, we need to offer sacrifices in order to placate that god, so he doesn't come and destroy our homes and our cities. So all of these, this divination of creation, which Egypt did, just as much as religions around the world have done, are nothing more than an attempt by humanity to deal with their greatest fear, that things aren't right between them and God, and that they could be destroyed. It demonstrates really the same thing that we demonstrate in the preaching of the law today, that things are not just broken, but dead, that humanity is in rebellion against God, and that something needs to be done. The only difference is we have the answer to that in Christianity, and it's not through all sorts of sacrifices on our part that's going to in some way appease the wrath of God. It's God's sacrifice of himself that is going to take care of the problem and reconcile us to God and bring about the peace and the protection that we only get as a result of Christ. So the other religions might be good at pointing out what's wrong with the world, what's wrong with themselves, but they don't have the answer. It's only the gospel that provides the answer to the same thing that most of these religions are seeking.
That's it. Be ready to look at some of these things.
Yeah, let's look at these. So we got the first one is the Nile turning into blood. So here's how I would start out. God talks to Moses again. He says, look, Pharaoh's heart is hard. He's stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. And so here's what I want you to do. So here we begin this first series. He says, go to Pharaoh in the morning as he's going out to the water and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile and take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. So he's got it all set up. He's going to meet him at the Nile early in the morning, staff in hand. And he's supposed to say, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But you have not listened until now. And then he says to raise the staff and to strike the water in the Nile so that it turns into blood. And that's exactly what happens. They strike the water of the Nile, and it turns into blood. And not only that, but because of that, the fish that are in the Nile, they die, and their rotting corpses turn the water of the Nile foul, so that in the end, the water is incapable of being used. And so as the story wraps up, the Egyptians are digging around the bank of the Nile to get water to drink, because they can't drink directly out of the river. But it's interesting that just like the magicians of Pharaoh imitated the staff turning into a serpent or a crocodile, so once more, the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. Now, we're not told if they reversed this or if they turned more water into blood or what they did, but it says they did the same with their secret arts. The important thing is that when Pharaoh saw this, his heart was hardened still more, and he didn't listen to them, just like God had said that he wouldn't. So this is the first plague, and it's significant, not only because it's first, but because it involves the Nile. Egypt is synonymous with the Nile. There was a 5th century BC Greek historian by the name of Herodotus who coined this phrase that you might have come across, where he said that Egypt is the gift of the Nile. The Nile gave Egypt to the world, in other words, because it was impossible for Egypt to exist without the Nile. One of the kind of the strange features about Egyptian topography is that sometimes you'll hear reference to Upper and Lower Egypt, but in this case, Upper Egypt is in the south and Lower Egypt is in the north. So it's direct opposite of what you'd expect, because the Nile flows from the south to the north. So it flows from the south and then it empties into the Mediterranean. But what it would do every fall, from about August to October, something like that, about that 3-month period, it would flood. It would be the annual inundation. And what would happen is, as the waters expanded, they would carry this nutrient-rich silt over the banks of the river and spread it out. And then as waters went down, the Egyptians were able to plant their crops in that rich soil and were able to grow abundant crops as a result of it. So the Egyptians used the Nile. They lived from the Nile like nothing else in their whole country. So without the Nile, Egypt wouldn't exist. Because of the Nile, Egypt was able to not only exist, but to thrive, to become one of the most incredible civilizations in the ancient world. Now, the reason this is all significant is because the very first thing that God attacks is the Nile. But there's also another reason that it's important that he attacks the Nile, and that's because what we were talking about earlier, the Egyptians, in addition to connecting gods and goddesses with other aspects of creation, also understood the Nile to be the personification of the god Hapi, H-A-P-I. So the Nile itself was understood to be kind of a visualization of this god. So when God has Moses turn the Nile into blood, it was his way not only of demonstrating his anger against Pharaoh and the Egyptians for what they've done to his people, but this was God's way of engaging in a divine war with the gods of Egypt. And in fact, we're told a little bit later, this is in chapter 12, we're told that one of the purpose of the 10 plagues was for God to attack the gods of Egypt, for Yahweh to attack the gods of Egypt. He says that he will strike down all the firstborn of Egypt. This is Exodus 12, both man and beast. And he says, against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am Yahweh. So it's one of the things that I don't think we always realize about the plagues is that the plagues were not only directed against Pharaoh and against the Egyptians, but also this was a theological war. This was a war of Yahweh against the false gods of the Egyptians. And the first one that he attacks is the river god, the god of the Nile. So this is the way it all started, and the Nile was like this. It says for seven days. This is the way it kind of all gets started. The plagues that are going to follow after this.
Yeah, and that is a huge deal too. I mean, because this isn't like turning the like you were pointing out, this isn't like turning, you know, the local lake into blood, but it's cool because, you know, you have city water, so it's gonna be fine.
Yeah,
it's not like that.
No, this was everything that the Egyptians needed. I mean, this was their, I guess, you know, this might be the equivalent of Moses and Aaron walking into the Oval Office and declaring to the president that they're going to shut down the U.S. economy for the next 7 days. Because this was the economy. This was their life. This was the livelihood. This was the life of the nation. And so for 7 days, it was ruined. It was spoiled. It was unable to be used. So this is a declaration of war against Pharaoh. It's a declaration of war against the Egyptians. And it, first and foremost, is a declaration of war against the false gods of the Egyptians. And this is when you, I think it helps too, because of course we're not part of this, part of this history. We're not part of this kind of the cultural understanding. So we don't always catch this, but one of the things that is part of this ancient world, kind of the mindset of the ancient world, is that every nation, every people, and every location, they had their particular gods. And these gods were understood to be more or less geographically bound. I mean, you've got the god of the Nile, right? That's where he's at. Or you have the god of a certain mountain. Well, that's where he's at. So there was a certain understanding that these divinities were spatially bound to certain places or certain kinds of geographical locations, whether that's a lake, a river, a mountain, a forest, whatever it might be. So this is like Yahweh invading the land of Egypt. He's coming onto soil where he's not supposed to be, because at least according to the Egyptian mindset, this is a foreign god invading their land, attacking their gods, and not only attacking, but he's demonstrating his victory over them time after time after time. So this is a theological invasion of the Egyptian pantheon, in which Yahweh demonstrates that he is not bound to some kind of geographical area. He's the Lord of the heavens and the earth, and he's come to demonstrate that the supposed lords of Egypt are nothing. They fall before him as nothing more than empty divinities. So that's plague one.
That's it.
We're rolling.
That's a lot on one plague there, man.
It is a lot on one plague. Yeah. Let's see what we got next. We don't move very far, because we're going to move this is the Nile part two, if you will, because the second plague is the plague of frogs. So once more, God tells Moses to go to Pharaoh and make the same demand: let my people go, that they may serve me. And if you don't, then I'm going to send frogs over your whole territory. The Nile is going to swarm with frogs. I love the image. This is verse 3 of chapter 8. It says, they'll come up and go into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed. if you're listening, of course, so you can't see Dan's face, but his face just communicated the disgust of thinking of imagine getting into bed and there's like 25 frogs between the sheets of your bed. That kind of gives you a very gross image of how disgusting this plague would have been. It says also they're going to go into your ovens and your kneading bowls and your kitchen too.
Yeah, dude, I think it's kind of funny that that God's like, okay, second plague, frogs. And he knows that he has to explain exactly how many frogs. I mean, not exactly how many frogs, but like what's going to happen with the frogs. Because let's be honest, if somebody's like, hey, do this thing or else I'm sending the frogs, you'd be like, yeah, all right. It's not like, you know,
lions.
Yeah, I'm sending the frogs. I mean, there is this sense in which you're like, right, the frogs. Like that's scary stuff.
Not a great frog phobia out there.
No, most people. I mean, yeah, maybe there's, you know, maybe there's some people, you know, that are like, you know, oh, gross, I don't want to touch a frog. But I don't think that's probably the case in this culture. I don't think anyone's got like some kind of, they're not grossed out or afraid of a frog. I feel like they're probably pretty cool with a frog. So when he says frogs, he has to then go in and be like you don't need, like, when I say a plague of frogs, I'm talking about frogs everywhere. Like, no escaping the frogs. There'll be so many frogs that they'll be forced into your homes.
You'll find them in your coffee cup in the morning.
Find them everywhere. Like, they just can't escape the frogs. And here's the thing, man. Like, frogs gotta poop. Frogs gotta pee. Like, I mean, like, you know, like it's gonna like this that many. If you're just talking about a plague of any kind of animal that has some kind of digestive system going on, any kind of animal that's not, you know, like a, I don't know, you know, worms or something, even just frogs, man, even though they're small, you don't want frogs pooping and peeing all over your house. And like, I mean, like you get, if you're a house full of frogs, it's going to like stink in there. And then like, I don't know what the lifespan of frogs, but people are going to start killing these frogs. And then you're going to have like burn piles of frogs. I mean, it's going to be a mess, dude.
That's what happens as the story goes on. Then, Pharaoh actually calls for Moses and Aaron, and he asked them to pray that the Lord would remove the frogs from his people.
Isn't it interesting that move doesn't really happen with the, like, just the frogs that instigate that move? Like, yeah. I can't take the frogs, man. I just can't take
I can take the Nile turning into blood, but get the frogs out of my bedroom and out of my kitchen, out of my throne room. I can't take him anymore.
It's weird. It's weird that he's like, the Nile turn to blood is like, you know what, we'll wait it out. The frogs, he's like, I can't handle the frogs, man. I can't handle it. I'm completely over the frogs.
And it's kind of humorous at the end, because God does get rid of the frogs, but not in really the way that Pharaoh wanted him to, because it says the frogs died. But where they died was in the house, in the courts, in the fields. And so they made these huge heaping piles of dead frogs. And as if we need to be told this, it says, and the land became foul. Yeah, I'm sure it did. You got piles of dead amphibians heaped all around the country. So, no telling how long, the land smelled like the rotting corpses of these frogs.
Man, there's where I live, every once in a while, I'll walk outside. You know, me and my wife will be like going somewhere, and we'll walk outside, and I'll get this big, gigantic nostril full of fertilizer. And I know that means that there's cornfields that are not far from my house. Yeah. And I know that they have fertilized the fields. And there's a bunch of fields around the town where I live, and the whole town smells like manure for like a week. Like for a week. It's just like every time you walk outside, you're like, good Lord, it smells like nature out here. Like it is, like this is too much.
Like living downwind from a pig farm.
Yeah, it's crazy. Now, I mean, that's nothing compared to what we're talking about. That's strategically placed fertilizer, you know, tilled into the ground. This is just heaping mounds of I don't even know how. Just I'm picturing just like pyramids of frogs that you. I mean, dude, you know that it is. I mean, there's probably like you probably got disease problems like going on. You got like, I mean, the like flies and maggots, and you've got just stench, man. You know it's miserable. People walking around just covering their faces. Sounds terrible.
It does. I wonder if anyone was eating while they were listening to this podcast. By the way,
sorry.
They might have had to put down their food. But yep. You know, you would think, as bad as this got, that would do the trick. You know, after the whole frog episode, then Pharaoh would realize the error of his ways, repent, and do what Yahweh wanted him to do. But we're told, as we come to the end of our 40 minutes here, we're told at the end of the second plague that when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, that they at least were dead, once more, he hardened his heart and did not listen to them, just like the Lord had said. I mean, this is a great illustration of the fact that sinners, the minute they find some sort of relief from whatever it is they're suffering from, are prone to harden their hearts. And instead of learning from that, instead of repenting, instead of seeking the forgiveness of the Lord and striving to do his will, they'll go right back to where they were before. So Pharaoh is not yet broken. His heart is still hard as can be. And it's going to take a lot more plagues to bring him to the point where he's going to actually let the Israelites go.
Yeah, that's a good illustration of why we constantly need law and gospel. We hear the law and we're despairing of ourselves. We get some relief, and you would think that, okay, good enough, but turns out you're going to need that law again later on. So that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, it's our constant need. And so, you know, we have our own plagues in our life. Maybe they're nothing like rivers turning into blood and frogs dying all around us. But we have the law preached to us because each of us are way too much like Pharaoh. And so we're shown our sin. We're called to repentance. We're admonished to confess. And God comes along and he forgives us. He gives us grace and mercy in Christ and points us toward the fulfillment, really, of all of these plagues and the death of the firstborn upon the cross, where we find true relief, where we receive a new heart and a new spirit, as Ezekiel says, and we're told that we have peace with Yahweh. We have peace with the Father through Christ.
Yeah. Well, all right, guys, that's it. Thank you again so much for joining us. Been a blast. 71 episodes in. We are. Don't feel like we're slowing down. We're gonna keep it rolling. So thanks so much. Share this podcast with your friends. Share it on social media. That stuff helps us out. Rate and review on iTunes. That gives us a little more visibility as well. And yeah. So thanks for sticking with us this long. And we will be back next week.